Cinematologist Podcast. I'm Neil Fox, and with me in the room opposite, literally a foot away, is my good friend Dario Linares. Hello, Dario.
Hey, Neil. I feel like I'm this phenomenological being now. You know, my material presence can be felt, although in podcast land it doesn't make that much of a difference. But mind you, I suppose, you know, we always say it's better when we do it in the room. So I don't know. It'd be interesting to hear if any of you out there, you know, can tell the difference when we're kind of together, or whether when we stitch it, you know, we edit it together over Skype afterwards, let us know. But it definitely is great to be down here after a overtly long train journey, extended by an hour, but I won't go into my travel problems. It's great to be here, and great to get a lot of taping done today.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it is really good to see you for an episode that we're putting out, which was long planned. But right now we're going to be sort of doing a kind of bonus main feed, you know, episode that's come out. We've not done anything in the last few weeks, so it'd be good to kind of get back into it. So we're going to be taping a lot today. A bonus, a full live episode, and also this special episode, which has come out of the London Film Festival and your recent kind of excursions to it. So do you want to let us know what
we're still for? Well, I mean, it's my infrequent excursions to the London Film Festival. It's just been a really hectic time of year, as it always is. And then the London Film Festival falls exactly at the beginning of term. So last year, if anybody remembers, you know, we got a couple of interviews in, and again, you know, just had a chat about various films. And again, this year, I've only managed to get to see three films from the festival. So we put a call out and tried to get, you know, somebody who would have seen quite a lot of the stuff that's coming out through the 2 weeks. And luckily, a good friend of yours, Neil, you tipped me off to them and put us in contact, and we had a chat.
Yeah, I saw that you were kind of in and out, and I think he posted on Instagram that he was there and remembered that he always covers it for a site that I write for called Director's Notes. So Mar Bell, who's the editor of that, yeah, I've known him a long time. As sort of listening to the conversation you had with him reminded me how long I'd known him, and kind of all the kind of history that we'd shared. I'd forgotten that when I ran a festival in Luton, we programmed his graduate short. So that was a kind of, not that, yeah, it feels, sounds bad, like I've forgotten the film. He'll be mad at me. But just kind of a long, been friends for a long time. And yeah, I write for Director's Notes, and I've just loved kind of being a part of that, which was, I think, is a really great site. Really kind of does what I think the internet does when it's really good, which is something specific, you know, like it's not a general site. It's got a name, it's got a kind of voice, it's got an identity, and he's really cultivated that. And I know when I'm thinking of something, I instantly go, that'll be a good fit for that site, because it's so clear what he's been doing. And it's been fun to work with him for a long time now.
I guess that's, you know, cutting through the noise of the internet, especially when you're writing about film, which, you know, everybody's got ownership over, it seems. And we have the same issue with the podcast, although, you know, I'd like to think that we do have a very strong identity on the podcast now, but finding that is often very difficult, I think. And even someone like myself, I mean, I think you read a lot more, you know, what I would call sort of classic film criticism online than I do. So sort of even cutting through to someone like me, who will read bits and pieces when it gets recommended to me, I won't go out and say I'm going to look for that. But, you know, reading your stuff on Director's Notes and one or two other people on there. And I think it does have this very niche position of kind of independent filmmaking at a low budget, people trying to get from one level to another. I think it caters for that very well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you know, as you kind of probably got from speaking to Marvin, you know, he has an independent sensibility. He's interested in how things get made at that level, you know, probably much more than he is at the top level, because it's kind of a very human kind of direct process. I think, you know, that point about us doing this, I think what I always, you know, when we started the podcast, I thought, oh, I wonder how what Marvin's going to think, you know, because I respect those things that come out from a need to do something. You know, we had a need that we thought we would want to do this thing, not like, oh, we should just do something and then it happened to be a podcast. And that's what I think about Director's Notes, is that was what he needed to do, was that site, not just I need to put my voice out into the world. Like, and I do think there's a difference, and I think you can tell if you read a lot of anything when people are doing it for genuine, heartfelt, kind of passionate reasons, and those who are just trying to look at me, aren't I doing stuff, you know? And I think we are in an age where there's so much of that, but it's nice that there's still good stuff around. And it's great to see that he's still kind of out there kind of covering London Film Festival sort of 10 years down the line. I mean, the amount of great stuff he's got, and the filmmakers he's speaking to, that commitment to indie is great, because he's spoken to filmmakers and got interviews with people who a lot of critics wouldn't pay attention to until they're in the main competition. But he was talking to people who had shorts in, who are now in main competition. I think that's really fascinating.
Okay, so this is me talking to Mar Bell. We were at the Picture Houses Central for this interview just last week. Unfortunately, it was very difficult to find somewhere quiet, and we were in this room that didn't have any music playing, but they had air conditioning blasting out, so the audio isn't brilliant. It's the best we could do with it, but hopefully that won't spoil your enjoyment too much and you'll get a sense of the conversation. So this is me talking to the editor of Director's Notes, Mar Bell. So, Mar Bell, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. I know we've been trying to do this for a while.
Yeah, it's been, a couple of years, I think, of near misses that I haven't made it on here. So.
Yeah, I know you've known Neil for quite a while.
Well, actually, Neil, he put on my graduate short from the University of Luton.
Right.
Played that, and then when I decided, there was a magazine called Showreel Magazine.
Oh, yeah.
That I went in, and thinking that they were going to ask me to stuff envelopes, and they were, what's your first article?
Yeah.
And so I was like, oh, I know somebody who started a film festival, which was obviously Filmstock. And so Neil and Justin were kind enough to be, I think, the first people I interviewed ever, really. And then they were also the first episode of the podcast on Director's Notes that we ever did for Clandestine. So yeah, we go back a long way.
I mean, just for listeners, like, Justin is the director who directed Neil's film that's just come out, Wilderness. Yeah. And you know, you're obviously writing and editor-in-chief, is it, of Director's Notes?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And how long has Director's Notes been going?
Jesus,
now?
We started in 2006, which is scary, so 12 years now.
Right.
And yeah, when we first started, it was mainly just because I wanted to do a podcast.
Right.
And so I spent a while going, what can I do a podcast about? And then it was kind of became obvious that the Director's Notes section that I used to write for Showreel magazine, where people would send in their shorts basically and I would write up and do interviews for the best ones, that seemed like an obvious fit, because people used to get in contact and like say, oh, that film sounded really cool, but where can I see it?
Mm.
And so with the podcast, when we first started, this was kind of, I suppose YouTube did exist, Vimeo not so much back then, 2006, so I used to have to get film directors to send me a copy of their film, like on mini DV, that I would then rip to glorious 320 by 240, exactly, and upload that on the podcast. So we kind of did the weekly podcast, and I think, you know, we didn't miss a week for like 5 years.
Wow.
And then it just became apparent that, because the turnaround time on that is, well, as you know from doing a podcast, it's a lot longer. So then we kind of moved into, we still do the podcast like now in London, we're going to have some episodes, but we started moving into kind of doing daily interviews with directors, kind of written Q&As and guest posts with them.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? Because it's like your podcast probably is more very industry focused or filmmaker focused in how do they make films, kind of way. Would you say that in comparison to ours?
That's
the critical element.
No, definitely. Look, the main reason I started the podcast was because I was planning to become a filmmaker. You know, that's what I kind of studied when I went to Luton.
Mm.
And I was kind of racking my brains of going, how can I get filmmakers to tell me everything about how they made their films so I can kind of copy that? And and that is completely the genesis of where the podcast came from. Then obviously I got more into the curatorial side of things and the I suppose journalism side of things.
Yeah.
So kind of that's where I sit now. But that's always been the ethos of, I want one of the podcasts and the site and the interviews we do to be, if you're a filmmaker and you see a film, I want it to be the questions that you would ask that filmmaker so that you could, as close as possible, replicate their process or at least learn the lessons that they learn.
Yeah, I mean, and it's interesting listening to a lot of podcasts that do have that kind of industry focus in terms of wanting to get information out of filmmakers about how to do certain things, whether it's script or camera and things like that. And playing that for students, I think, is always kind of interesting, because
sometimes, I mean, I know you teach as well, you can sort of give directions and say, do this, do that, this is the way that it's done in the industry. But then when they hear someone that maybe they know or recognize say it, I don't know, it seems to have that kind of validity. Maybe it's the star quality and everything.
No, it's true. But and also, I kind of always had, it's weird, not a problem with listening to it. I like critical think pieces and things like that. But I always used to wonder when, you know, you read a film critic say, oh, clearly he chose this shot because it meant this and it's this about the characters. And yes, obviously that does happen. Mm-hmm. But most of the time, they don't know. They haven't spoken to the filmmaker. And what I have found through the years is, you know, I'll go, oh, that shot that you did, that was absolutely gorgeous. That one take shot that traveled down through the city. And they went, well, you know, actually what happened was there was a van that was parked in the way that we couldn't find out who owned it, and so we had to work around it, or we were running out of time, and so we came up with the shot. Yeah. And so kind of to me there's always been this kind of disconnect between when critics go, clearly they meant this, and okay, if you've spoken directly to the director and they've told you that, yeah, fair enough. But what I found is, yeah, like the directors came up with a clever way around the problem,
yeah,
really, and yes, you can imbue meaning into it, but it wasn't necessarily always planned, yeah, like that.
It kind of undermines that whole school of critical theory that talks about the intentionality of the director, and you know, you marry that up, because as you say, it's unless you actually know, then again it's your own interpretation.
Yeah, no, completely.
So just before we get onto the London Film Festival, which is of course why we're meeting really, how do you see the difference in terms of podcasting versus writing in terms of the way that they perhaps engage with film? Do you think that there's a sort of major difference in the form and what it allows you to do, maybe as a critic and also as a filmmaker?
Well, I don't know, because I think from our point of view, I think our interviews that we do that are written versus the podcast, they're quite similar.
Mm.
So I mean, in the type of conversations we have and the kind of type of engagement and the depth that we will go to. As I was saying earlier, for me, the reason that I kind of started embracing writing more than the podcast, although, like I said, the podcast, even though it looks like it quite often, isn't dead, and we kind of resurrect every time there's a film festival or something like that. But the reason that I did that was to be able to bring out more content and talk to more directors.
Sure.
But I think from our point of view, we still have the same conversations. It's the same. We engage with the topic of film in the same way.
Yeah.
Now, I know, like, different podcasts, I mean, and I listen to far too many podcasts on triple speed, so I can get through more podcasts.
I have a feeling.
Really. And so I think there might be a difference for them.
Mm.
But personally, I kind of see it as one in the same, really,
okay,
the way that I approach it.
Yeah. Because so if you listen to sort of Film Comment or Curz on podcasts and stuff like that, they do mention the stuff that's in the magazines or on the websites, but it does seem to be a kind of separate thing. So it's interesting that you see that as quite a strong correlation.
For us it's kind of the same. The intention is always the same. I always want to go in knowing more about the film. And also when it comes to doing the interviews, I remember when I first started covering the London Film Festival, which was pretty much, I think, 2007, might have been the first one we came to. And there used to be this thing where I would sit down with the director and they would go, well, have you seen the film? And I kind of had it in my head that it's, oh, because I was just from some blog and I wasn't from Variety. And so, but I found out that this whole festival circuit thing, I think people get sent out with assignments of, you need to talk to such and such.
Yeah.
And whether they've seen the film or not, they have to do the interview.
Mm.
And so I can imagine how frustrating it is for the filmmakers. Because for me, one of the things that I really love to do is I love to find an existing interview with the director or, you know, decent press kit, and then I kind of will ask the follow-up questions.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because you have time in the junkie.
Yeah, exactly. Because for me, that's what's much more interesting is getting to the depth of it. I'm not very interested in the surface questions of how was it to work with such and such, because I don't really care. And nobody's ever going to tell you the truth anyway, really.
No, we have the same issue of doing stuff that's up to date. I mean, we have done films that are coming out now, but we just never want to get into that kind of press junket mentality where somebody's on to sell a thing. We actually want to look at it in that distance, as you're talking about. So What are we, about halfway through the London Film Festival?
No, we're nearly at the end. We've got like, it's what, the Saturday, so we've got one more day.
Oh God.
Yeah.
See, this is the problem for us. It's like it falls exactly at the wrong time in terms of
the
teaching.
Start of term, isn't it?
So yeah. There's just no chance of following. So we really thank you for coming on and talking about some of the stuff you've seen. I mean, generally, how do you think the year has been in terms of quality or stuff that you've enjoyed versus not?
Yeah, no, I think it's kind of, for me, it kind of felt like it was starting a little bit slow, and I think I kind of went into a couple of things that disappointed me. And again, I think partly a couple of those were because they'd been blown up so much. So for instance, like, now I just want to say I enjoyed Sorry to Bother You,
okay,
but everything that I've read and seen about Sorry to Bother You, yeah, was going, oh my God, this is amazing. Yeah. The new Get Out, and it is very good, and I kind of wish that I had seen it without all that hype beforehand.
Sure.
Because so I kind of left a little bit disappointed, even though it is very clever, it's very inventive, it takes a kind of, won't spoil it for anyone, but it takes a weird turn in the like latter third. Mm.
So who's the director of this one?
All right, so that's Boots Riley. He's a director, I believe, like he's a rapper as well. And so, yeah, like I said, it's not that it's like, it is a good film.
Mm.
But again, one of the things that I like about coming to this festival and other festivals is that you get to see, because the films aren't out yet, you get to see them without all the hype,
yeah,
really. So because this was kind of hyped up, I think, you know, your expectations are set really, really high.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's kind of really hard for things to live up with that. And then, like, another early film that I saw was Widows.
Okay.
Steve McQueen.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I've just done an episode on him. So it's an interesting one, that, because obviously brought from a TV show.
Yeah.
And maybe a little bit more generic than previous movies.
I mean, so that's the thing. Like, I like Steve McQueen's work, and I know that it was kind of quite divisive on the Instagram show. I remember listening to that episode. But Widows, it feels like it's well made. I'd say it's worth watching, but it doesn't feel like a Steve McQueen film.
Okay.
So, yeah, you know, if I'm going to see a Steve McQueen film, I want it to feel like, it felt like it could be, anybody else could have directed that,
sure,
which is, I think, no matter where you fall on his earlier films, you wouldn't say that about any of those. Yeah. They're very much authored pieces. Mm. Whereas this, it kind of feels like a journeyman director could have.
Well, that's one of the points we said on our show, that actually his early work is so kind of off him, or idiosyncratic, or specific to him, let's say.
Yeah.
But then, you know, even when you get to 12 Years a Slave, which is a big, important story that obviously he wanted to tell,
yeah,
it kind of is molded, you know, it can't help but be molded into that sort of Hollywood big grand picture.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Great. So, yeah, I mean, is that one that you think is probably, you know, not going to stand the test of time, maybe?
Well, no, I don't think if you're going back through and you're going to be, you know, in however many years reviewing, sure, his body of work, you're going to, you know, pick
that out.
Yeah, kind of thing. Like, for instance, you know, like Hunger, we've got, you know, the conversation that they have that's, what's it, like 15 minutes long or something like that.
Yeah, the one take.
Yeah.
And his actors under pressure for that.
Yeah,
sure,
exactly. So it's not something that I think is going to stand out like that.
So what do you think has been your real kind of highlight? What's the
Well, I mean, I think, well, it must really speak to me, and maybe not in a good way, as in, I think that, like, the two that have stood out the most for me, there's been a few that have stood out for me, are kind of really harrowing films.
Okay.
So I would say, like, so, and again, I saw this for, like, I don't know, maybe about 3 days in, but Utoya, July 22nd.
Oh, yes.
You know, about the, you know, the Norway, right, right-wing extreme issue, shot all those kids on the island of Utøya. It's an amazing piece of filmmaking. It's like, it's, you know, it's one take. And we follow this girl who's like an amalgam of lots of stories. So I spoke to the director, Eric Puppe, and he was saying about that he didn't want it to be a specific story because he didn't want a parent to be watching it and going, oh, is that my daughter, is that her friend, etc.
Yeah.
But he did did about a year and a half of research and interviews,
sure,
so that, and you totally feel immersed. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those that, you know, I felt unsettled the whole way through, and then when it finished, I was like, oh, it's finished now.
Kind of. So is it a bit like Gus Van Sant's Elephant or something?
Yeah, but, like, I'd say kind of even more intense, and you kind of feel the confusion of, you know, that they felt at the time, like, you don't know where the shots are, you don't know how many people are there, kind of thing, and you're just kind of in the moment as you go through it, well, moment by moment, because it's kind of, it's a real-time It's a real time thing. And I'm really interested to see, is it Paul Greengrass has done the,
I've watched it,
the Netflix one?
Yeah.
Which is a completely really, different
yeah,
take.
It's, I mean, it. That is really powerful as well. I mean, I've sat down to watch it with my girlfriend. She had said, I can't watch this. It, obviously, the sort of moment of following the killings that were going on the island, but then there was the follow-up of the trial. So it's very much centered, I think, around Breivik as the as the killer in a way.
Yeah, whereas this one, at one point you see him in the distance as like somebody's kind of popping up to kind of find him. So you don't see him, it never names him. And so I know that, again, from talking to Eric, that the intention was to kind of bring the story back to the victims, because, you know, people know loads and loads about the shooter, as happens all the time with these mass shootings, really. And that's kind of always been that bone of contention as to, are they doing it for fame, and are you kind of feeding their own narrative when you do that? And so, like, he kind of did this as this reclamation of, like, these are the people who are important in this story, and it's their story as opposed to his story. And I think he's completely successful with that.
I mean, it will be a very interesting watch after seeing, and for you the other way, for seeing the other one, because it's the Paul Greengrass one is very much his kind of very, it's sort of deadpan action in a way, you know, that sort of style with the handheld camera, and very much sort of moving from character to character and episode to episode in this. He's trying to be aspirational, to be objective, you know what I mean? It's sort of pseudo-documentary in that way, but, you know, it can't be. It's always got to be political. And in the end, I did feel that the Breivik character was kind of given a charisma, which you always kind of worry about, I think, when you're watching these kinds of films.
Yeah, definitely.
So what was the other one?
So going from traumatic to traumatic, Holiday by Isabella Eklof.
Oh, okay.
And so the basic premise is there's this young girl, kind of like early 20s, who's the girlfriend of this gangster, like kind of Danish gangster fellow, and they're on holiday with like some friends, you know, kind of co-gangster type things, the Turkish Riviera. And it's kind of, it's about her kind of, I suppose, getting to grips with, but not knowing ahead of time what the rules are for the life in that. So, you know, she's his girlfriend, you see her flirting with somebody else, and you feel that you like, that's not going to stand.
Right.
And it's her kind of finding the boundaries there. Now, the thing that has, I suppose, that has been most talked about in this film when it's played at other festivals is that there is a really kind of shocking, brutal kind of, kind of brutal because of the nature of it, but not brutal as in, like, violence as in hitting. Well, it's kind of, it is pretty graphic. There's a rape of the boyfriend, the gangster boyfriend, and the main character, who's played by this first time, although I think she's got quite a few films coming out. I think she was in three films at once, and this happens to be the first one. Yeah, exactly. She's fantastic. She's called Sasha Victoria Carmen Song. Really long name. And the camera, it's like, it's just a long take, and it watches from a slight distance as if you're somebody in the room. And it's, and it is kind of grab, like you see an erect penis and you kind of go through the motion. And it's a really, really hard watch, but it's fantastically done. And one of the things when I was talking to Isabella that she said that she wanted to do was, there's this kind of view that, you know, rape and like things, you know, bad things that happen, they kind of happen down dark alleyways and such.
Sure.
But this film is like, it's gorgeous. The villa that they're staying in is gorgeous. It's glitzy. The clothes are fantastic. And she kind of wanted, and also, you know, the gangster boyfriend, he's got charm. You know, he's attractive, and you could kind of see why somebody would be attracted to him. And so, you know, one of the things that she said when I spoke to her was she wanted to show that bad things don't just happen in dark corners, and you know, you can only address these bad things that are happening. And her film has quite rightly and intentionally, it's been kind of tied in with the, you know, the Me Too movement and the Time's Up movement.
Yeah, yeah.
And she's saying how, you know, the world's kind of run by these charismatic psychopaths, but nobody ever talks about it. It's always meant to be some kind of grubby person, you know, hiding in the shadows. And she's like, if you don't kind of confront that, and that's one of the things she wanted to do with the film, to show that, no, it happens in these lovely, splendid places.
Yeah.
Then the problem's never, never going to get solved, really.
Sure. So have you seen anything that is kind of considered or is in the sort of main competition that you might want to highlight to us? Because I've seen a couple of the biggest, I've only seen two of the movies, and they are with two of the big name directors that are here, which is obviously always what you get at the London Film Festival.
Well, I suppose one of the, because my approach to the festival is generally, unless it's somebody that I know that I have a great fondness for their work, if it's a big film, I kind of avoid it because I'm going to get to see it later, whereas a lot of these, they don't get distribution. But I did see the new Ben Wheatley one, Happy How New Year, Colin Burstyn. It was good. I mean, I'm a fan of Ben Wheatley. Anybody who's followed the podcast for a while knows that I've been speaking to him for years, since Down Terrace, all the way through Kill List, etc. And it feels kind of like a return to that Down Terrace domesticity.
Sure.
Kind of, you know, it's basic, the basic premise is this family go away for New Year, and it's all the petty squabbles that come up with the family, and there's like a brother who's been out of the picture for a while, and then when everybody finds out he's turning up, it's like, why have you invited him? And you know, things kind of kick off. But you know, when you say Ben Wheatley, you're expecting that there's going to be like, you know, some kind of lots of blood or massive violence.
Kick off at some
point. But it's more, you know, an emotional violence, I would say.
Sure.
And that whole thing of, I think people would recognize it from, from your own family. You know, there's people who don't get on in the family, and it's kind of that kind of niggling and sniping and arguments. And so, it kind of, to me, it felt like him returning back to his kind of the down terrace.
Yeah, it's an interesting move though, that if you think of his career, and obviously he sort of was doing those films, then he did the very, very sort of strange
Field of England, which is fantastic. Yeah,
of his.
Yeah.
But then High Rise and Free Fire, which, you know, I mean, I love the book High Rise. I wasn't so enamored with the film. I don't know, like, Neil liked Free Fire, and I was kind of like, whatever, you know what I mean? So, I mean, does this look like a sort of move, not backwards, but back to sort of something that he knows to kind of reset or something
like I said, I've spoken to him lots of times, and hopefully I'll speak to him again for this one. And it's just, I know from those conversations that we've had that he's always got like at least three projects of different budget levels ahead. And he never wants, like he said to me before, that he always wants to make like a film a year. I think this has been kind of maybe his longest break in between films. So for instance, like you spoke about a field in England, and I know that like he said that he slotted that in then because it felt like he was going on to High Rise, so it felt like now's the time I'm going to be able to do this weird English Civil War film that's going to be in black and white kind of thing. So I don't know, again, because I haven't spoken to him yet about this one, where this kind of sits, but it kind of feels, because it's very contained in this kind of house, and the cast is stellar, so it feels like one of the ones that that maybe while waiting for another project to come into place this is the one that we can make now and we can most really fund ourselves, kind of thing, because they've always been, like Rook Films have always been pretty smart about the smaller films that they make, about that they can fund them themselves, and then they're of a size that they can recoup, which I always find really interesting, because I can understand why a lot of directors that, you know, you talk to, I'm sure that you have the same, the business thing is an afterthought, really, when it kind of, if you want to keep on making work, you need to engage. You need to engage in it. And I know that's something that, you know, they're very cognizant on, because his producer is his longtime producer. I think produced everything that they've ever done. So it's that partnership, really.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting kind of understanding of how the film industry works, especially when you get to a certain level. I mean, we're always, it's really easy, I think, to criticize directors who sort of, you know, use that word selling out. But it's never really that easy, isn't it? I think that just getting any kind of film off the ground, you have to have these sort of expectations about what any particular project can or can't do. So having these different levels, I think, is probably where most people are doing.
No, well, definitely. Because, you know, if you don't, you know, if you take other people's money and you don't make them their money back, then you're not going to get
another one,
really. So,
it's just remembering that films are a commercial beat.
As much as we'd like to pretend it isn't.
Yeah, it's true. So, is there any other highlights you want to mention?
I mean, let me have a look here, actually. Oh, Jesus, actually, yeah. I also saw Ray and Liz by Richard Billingham, who, I mean, I wasn't really familiar with his work until I kind of looked it up afterwards, but he's a photographer and an artist who uses quite often in his work, in his photography and his art, his family, like they're like from the Black Country. And so this is a story, and I think as well he had a book of photographs that kind of was a almost preempted this story, and it's basically of his parents and his upbringing in the Black Country, and his father's an alcoholic and his mum's chain smoking, like brutal, scary matriarch of this family. And it reminded me, you know, I grew up in Bradford, like estates in Bradford, and it totally reminded me of that. Yeah, it felt really authentic. So it totally reminded me of that authentic, you know, people right. that you'd see on the estate, and right. you're like back, wow. yeah, kids, like, you know, so, you know, there's a young kid in it, his brother, you know, kids out, you know, who were far too young to be out, yeah, in the back streets, out at, like, you know, late at night, you know, at night time and things like that. So yeah, and it's so it's great. So it's kind of, you know, it's quite heartbreaking. There's you know, neglect in a. Just in the, I suppose, the definition of the word, of really not necessarily paying that much attention to the kids.
Right.
Really, there's a bit where where the young kid goes missing for a couple of days, and they walk past him like, "Where have you been?" Like, not really with much concern. You'd expect a parent to have, but. I had friends like that, and I've got three sons now, and we always know where they are.
Yeah.
Like, my parents didn't know where I was.
It's like, come back at dinner time.
I remember we used to get on our bikes and you'd ride away for half the time to get as far as you can and then reappear. They didn't know what we did, really. So it totally reminded me of that, and it felt very, very authentic. And well, I can imagine why it is, because it's his life, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting. It's like, I mean, I don't have any children, but I know that idea of get out of the house and go look after yourself for a day and come back at 5 o'clock is just gone now. It's everything such structured time.
You know? And like, where, you know, the like find my family app on your on your phone. Really.
Wow.
Yeah.
So as you say, there's a couple of days left. Have you got anything left that you're really looking forward to seeing?
The one that I'm really looking forward to, I got managed to get tickets for because I missed the press screening because it was oversubscribed, is Thunder Road by Jim Cummings. So like he did, that was a short film, and I've tried not to read too much about it as I do, but I know it's based on the short film that he did, and it used made some noise online. One, because it's like a one take thing. Basically, the basic premise is there's this cop who's giving a eulogy at his mother's, I believe it's his mother's funeral, and it's all done in one take, and he kind of uses the lyrics from Bruce Springsteen's Thunder Road.
Okay.
And so he had done a, open letter to be able to use the lyrics.
Right.
And he got the permission. And so I know that, like, so he's gone and he did another kind of one take thing, which I believe was called The Robbery, about a messed up kind of meth smoking girl who goes into a convenience store to try and rob it, and the convenience store owner fights back and stuff. So I really like his style. So I'm curious as to kind of how that is going to expand out to the feature. So that's one thing that I'm really, really looking forward to seeing this evening.
Brilliant. Well, Marbel, thanks very much for finally getting the time arranging the time together. It's been great to speak to you, and hopefully we'll talk to you again on the podcast soon.
Yeah, definitely. My pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, so we got through quite a range of subjects there, actually, just sort of listening back on it. So I don't know, Neil, was there anything that you wanted to pick out and just some sort of comment on?
Yeah, I mean, it's really great to hear him on the podcast. You know, like, I think he's a really smart and astute kind of critic, and he's got a very particular taste, which I think is well formed, and you really get a sense of what he's into, and he's able to articulate it really well. It was just nice to hear him talk on our podcast, you know, having worked with him for so long. It was interesting when you asked him about, you know, the difference between kind of written and audio or video recorded interviews and his response. And what I realized that what I'd been doing, because I do a lot of interviews for the site with filmmakers, is I'd obviously been following that way of doing it, because unlike everywhere else, I'll record all my interviews I do for director's notes audio first and then transcribe to try and keep that feel, because I love the podcast interviews so much. So, and I'd never really consciously realized that, and you know, so I don't like doing them by email for director's notes. I like having a conversation with the filmmaker then trying to get that. So I can see what he means by trying to keep that part of it. And I think that one of our graduates that we know from here in Falmouth, James Matra, writes for the site as well, does a lot of interviews now, and I think he's the same, you know,
he tapes it as well. But it's interesting because it taps right into my chapter on in the podcasting books. I was just, everybody seems to agree with, not agree with me, but agree with that sentiment that there is a difference, or that when you record an interview and you speak to somebody and then you're articulating what they're saying in text, the translation of those two things are interrelated, but they are, you know, they do create a separate sort of sense of, I don't want to say knowledge or information. It's very difficult to sort of pin that down, but there is a sort of difference, even though they're connected.
Yeah, I think it definitely creates a, what the right word is difficult, isn't it? But there is a sense of the dialogue. There is a sense of the thought that, you know.
It's the dialectic producing the information or the knowledge, really.
Which I think is fascinating.
Yeah,
you know,
it is.
And I think you do, and I think you can be critical and think when you read stuff like, oh, that's an email interview, or that's someone who spent a lot of time, and that's a live conversation almost kind of being reported. That was interesting. Interesting to, you know, having listened to a lot of podcasts and about what was playing at the festival, it was interesting to hear kind of some of his thoughts where, you know, which is great because he doesn't go with consensus a lot of the time, you know, which is always more interesting than, you know, but sort of seeing what some people and places were writing about stuff and then his kind of response to it was interesting. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't particularly care for the Steve McQueen, I thought. I mean, he was giving it as much due attention as he wanted to give it, which I mean, it's funny because I think it probably chimed with the experience I had watching the Carol Morley film, Out of Blue, which I really wanted to like. And I kind of didn't, you know, and it's funny because there's a lot of people online who are sort of bigging it up, and, you know, the other places that have really torn it apart, you know, some of the sort of festival criticism it's got from Film Comment, isn't it, on their episode, they really took it apart. And I think it's got things that are interesting, but it sounds glib to say it's an admirable failure. But yeah, on the other hand, I think there are a lot of people bigging it up because, in a sense, you know, it's very difficult to say this, but, you know, because it's a female filmmaker, I think a lot of people want to give it that sense of space and that sense of attention, which is absolutely due. But at the end of the day, I didn't care for it. I didn't think it was that great.
Yeah, I mean, that ties in with that Wesley Morris piece, which, you know, has been doing the rounds and getting a lot of kind of discussion about what criticism is and what, how you position yourself in relation to work at the moment, and is it always political, you know? And I think that the reality is that if Cara Morley's film is absolutely slated by everyone, it makes it very hard for her to get, and if it's just a work, film that doesn't quite work. So, and how much does that feed in where you don't want to lambast it because we know that the filmmaker is so closely tied to it? And that might mean, well, that was badly reviewed, she won't get any more money, which would be a real shame.
Exactly.
She's a very, you know, interesting filmmaker, and it might be that she's had a misfire.
So, but plus also, I would be the first to acknowledge that men are allowed to fail more times than women. You know what I mean?
That's totally true. Yeah.
So I don't feel like, as you know, as a critic, you should, you know, base that your judgment on the film in and of itself because of that, even though you're acknowledging that context.
Yeah, the work has to stand up for itself.
At the end, it does, doesn't it?
Which obviously is, and we are in that time where it's difficult to navigate that a lot. So you saw the Carol Morley. What else did you see?
Well, interestingly enough, I got the last ticket, you know, on standby for the David Lowery, which is just perfect timing for our next episode, which will be coming hot on the heels of this one on A Ghost Story. And, you know, I'm not going to talk about A Ghost Story here because I'm going to have a lot to say about it in the next episode, but I really do like this filmmaker because of that film primarily. And I really was happy to get in and see this, and he was there, and I got a question in.
What did you ask?
Well, I asked him at the very end, there were sort of various questions. It was, and he'd alluded to the fact this is Robert Redford's last film. And I asked him, when did he find out when it was Robert Redford's last film? Did he discuss it with Redford? And then what kind of pressure did he feel on the back of that? Because The film is very much an ode to Robert Redford's career, and Robert Redford as an icon that's put on top of this very enjoyable narrative and sort of setup and relationship that he has with Sissy Spacek, who is as luminous in it as he is. But, you know, he's using all of the charm that Robert Redford still possesses in troves, and he drops that smile in a way that is just, you know, you just know you're dealing with someone who is a movie star. And it's not a smile of, say, a Tom Cruise, which can be sort of smarmy, you know, or a wolfish smile like Jack Nicholson. It's a smile that is just warm and open and sexy, let's be honest. And even sort of on the crags of his face. I mean, there's this one cutaway where they cut back to him, to a photo of him, a little snippet of him when he was 25 with the smile. And you just, I mean, it's just obvious why this guy's a movie star. And he, you know, there's scenes that reference exactly Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and All the President's Men and, you know, various films going way back in his career.
And there's footage from The Chase in there as well.
Right. Absolutely. And it's just a really, really enjoyable film that is clearly, I don't want to say pandering because that's a sort of negative connotation, but referencing this sense of here is a star who will no longer be with us, and here is his send-off on screen, and I have a responsibility to deliver that. And I think Lowry was very clear about that.
Yeah, I mean, because you sort of shared a piece with Lowry sort of talking about it, and, you know, and he sort of mentioned that. And what I thought was interesting, my interesting thought was, well, Redford's putting that pressure on himself as well. Yeah. You know, that must be an interesting shared experience where if he says it, kind of, does he have to stick to it? And what? How does he? And I was interested, like to know how he felt about the work he was doing, knowing this is it, you know. So that was, I think it's a really fascinating kind of project. I'm excited to talk about Ghost Story because I'm a Lowry fan, you know, I'm a fan of the project, as they say. So I'm really pleased that does what it looks like it's going to do. So I'm excited to see that.
Cool. So maybe, I mean, you have gone through the festival system from both ends. And I know that obviously that's what I was talking about with Marbel a little bit. And I'm just wondering if you see festivals now as having a sort of slightly different role in film culture more broadly. I mean, it seems to me there's still this sort of conduit to be able to see stuff that you wouldn't necessarily see elsewhere. But it almost seems that's even stronger now. But on the other hand, film festivals seem more of a business than they ever have.
Yeah, I mean, so yeah, as was kind of alluded to, I'm not sure how much we've talked about it on the podcast. I ran a film festival for 10 years called Filmstock in Luton, and at the same time was making films and kind of sending films out to festivals, and that was weird, kind of doing both. It has kind of, programming a festival made me realise what programmers go through, but also what we did as a festival, which was quite unique, was there was two of us, myself and Justin, who make films with as well, and we watched everything. And that's not always the case. Yeah. Certainly not the case at big festivals, that the programming teams see everything that comes in.
It's farmed out to people, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, which has, I find, deeply problematic. Particularly, I think, if you're, you know, when you know how the film industry works a lot of the time, and you know that most of the people in, without being disrespectful, low-ranking positions, readers, viewers, kind of assistants, are not that necessarily, they don't love cinema. They might love movies, but they don't love cinema in the same way, or they don't have as broad a taste as the programming team. And you're doing something that is very, very specific. I think we've struggled in the past with submitting to festivals where the people who watched it, first of all, just haven't known what we're trying to go for.
Mm.
Because I think that the critical response to stuff, and when we've got it in front of people higher up, has been very, very different. They get, we made a 60s crime film in the, like an homage to Jean-Pierre Melville, so not even Goddard. We went, do you know what I mean? So if you don't know what Melville was doing, and you watch this really slow, ponderous, metaphysical crime movie, like, you probably think nothing was going on, and it was the same with Wilderness, you know? I do struggle, which is why I've kind of strayed away from a lot of the big festivals in the last few years, because, like, it's too much of a risk. Who's going to watch it? And do they know? Not to say whether it's any good or not, but can they watch it and go, okay, this is, I know the Cassavetes thing.
Yeah.
So I can watch it in that context. Where it's like, well, these are just two people kind of talking about, and nothing's really happening in it. So that is something that has always kind of struck me as despite how big festivals have got, they've never really solved the problem of who watches the stuff, first of all. But of course, most of the stuff that screens at the big festivals is picked because filmmakers or film, you know, kind of national bodies have direct access to programs. You know, so you have to have a name or reputation or be funneled through the BFI, you know, in order to get directly to the programmers. And, you know, time and money and everything means that how far beyond that do they ever look, you know? And I think it is very, very difficult unless you go through, unless you've kind of got a really unique project. How do you get around that? And I don't know, again, I don't know how you solve that.
I guess there's levels of festival though now as well that are very clearly demarcated.
Yeah, there's more festivals than ever.
Yeah.
You know.
And also I think that like the bigger festivals, it's not just about the bigger movies now. I mean, I saw this, the third movie I saw at the festival was this Bill Murray story. Stories. So it's a sort of documentary. Well, it is a documentary, but it's a very contrived documentary. And it's very fun because it's got loads of clips of Bill Murray in it, and it's about this sort of urban legend that he sort of turns up and does these wacky things at different places. Really watchable, but clearly a sort of designed as a low budget, straight to Netflix, aping on the documentary filmmaker trying to get his film made and trying to meet Bill Murray. So very, you know, referencing sort of Michael Moore trying to meet, you know, Roger Ailes back in the day. And this was clearly a film that was wanting to get picked up for streaming on Netflix, it seemed to me, just from its aesthetic and you know, the way it was put together. And I was just wondering, you know, why is that at this festival? And probably it's at this festival because it's Bill Murray, and anyone, it will pack out a room. And it was on the Sunday afternoon, the last day of the festival, the room was packed out because anyone will come and see Murray. Yeah. But it's almost kind of like, I didn't think that film has probably got a straight to streaming deal, I would guess. Yeah. And you know, it was sad because it was kind of like the film festival space could have been with something really interesting and sort of strange and idiosyncratic. But again, you know, is really the London Film Festival a home for things like that?
Yeah, I think that does seem to be something that is kind of part of the conversation about festivals, is what should they be showing? And it's kind of, again, like everything's a double-edged sword. You know, if you've got an actor in it that's recognisable, then that's a good thing. If it's a genre that is easily pinned, then, you know, it's a horror movie, or it's a, you know, it's an indie road movie, or it's a kind of psychological thriller like Paranormal Activity or something like that. Like, okay, well, that's a very easy sell in terms of a quick tagline. But if you're doing something which is not like that, that's what festivals are for, is to kind of do that. The problem is that festivals are kind of the only space where films could be launched now if they're not already sold.
Yeah.
And that, there's fewer films being released from that space than ever. I mean, there's more films being released, people are saying, but a lot of films going to festivals are not being picked up. You know, big films that are kind of not being, you know, like a great example is something like Snowpiercer, which has never been released in the UK.
Yeah.
That's a massive film with massive stars. It played festivals and did really well. It's had some, but so, you know, festivals, if they're going to remain relevant, are kind of going to be spaces that launch films into that Oscar race, into that, you know, and that's, there's a great series. If people are interested in more, there's the former Maryland program and critic, I think his name's Eric Allen Hatch. I'll put a link up on the show notes from, he's been writing for Movie about the responsibilities of film festivals.
And it
is that, like, you know, we should be championing films that we know are not going to get that push, because otherwise what is this space for? And I think that is a part of it. It's definitely something that we tried to do at Filmstock, which is kind of think, okay, the reason we watched everything was because we'd never wanted to be in where people said, how did this get programmed? And I've been to festivals as a filmmaker and thought, who programmed this? You know, like, it might have a certain name, but it's not a very good movie, and it doesn't hold up against the rest of the stuff. And we never wanted to be in a position where we couldn't justify. And we might pick stuff that was flawed or a bit raggedy, but we always knew why. First-time filmmaker or interesting subject matter, or interesting style that, you know, but you could say to people when they said, and they did say a couple of times, like, why did you pick that? You could say,
yeah.
And I think that was important to us. And also, like, what would the audience appreciate? What would be a good mix of stuff that would challenge an audience, and then in amongst that kind of stuff that they're going to enjoy, you know, particularly in Luton. I mean, we had an audience that had never had a film festival before, doesn't have an art house cinema. So the stuff we were programming was, you know, literally you couldn't, particularly in the early 2000s, couldn't see anywhere else.
Yeah.
So there is a responsibility to entertain with a Bill Murray-esque, but the balance is really, really key. And, you know, a festival like London, the program this year looked superb in terms of that Oscar high level art house. You know, like the festival circuit this year seems really, really strong. From, you know, not necessarily Cannes, but the Autumn Festivals definitely. But there may have been some films there. But for me in Cornwall, looking at the coverage, I'm only seeing the fest. I'm only seeing same coverage on films that played at Toronto, Venice, Telluride, and that's the films that are now playing in London. That everyone's, it's like, well, what else is on that program? It's a big program.
Yeah.
Where's the coverage of these smaller films, which would also benefit from that kind of thing? And that's always disappointing that there's no real concerted effort to celebrate the work that's not going to be in my cinema in Falmouth.
Yeah.
You know, like Widows. I do want to see it, but it's always going to get released.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, we've talked about this before in terms of what certain outlets do in terms of what they look like they're doing or what they should be doing, like what they seem to say their kind of modus operandi is and what they end up doing, which is basically talking about Oscar bait. And it's like, that's still disappointing.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that film festivals are helping with the broadening for the audience in terms of preparing an audience for stuff that is different. I mean, that's part of a bigger picture, which maybe we might touch upon again next time. But that'll do, I think, for this episode. Thanks very much, Neil. Great to talk to you. Great to be here.
You too, yeah. This is fun.
Yeah, this has kind of found a little niche spot that we're going to put it out in between, and we've got a ghost story coming up on our next episode. Please, again, as usual, contact us on the email cinematologists@gmail.com or on Twitter @cinematologists. Until next time, that's been the Cinematologist Podcast. Thanks for listening. Tumble and find they are beautiful. On the hilltops at night they are beautiful. And blazing with light is the widest and the tallest and the biggest one.